These were arrangements whereby one nation claiming the territory occupied by Indians established the exclusiveness of its claim in reference to other European powers. So you didn't have battles over the same turf. If Spain claimed Area X, that meant the English shouldn't poach there, or the French, or the Portuguese, and likewise. So it was a system of reciprocity to avoid having, what hadn't happened anyway, wars among the colonial powers for that territory. It meant that if that claim, if that right of preemption could be sustained, that the Indians living on any given territory, when they wished to transfer title, could only transfer to one European power. They couldn't bargain for the best deal. If it was English, if it was an English territory, they could only sell, if they wished to sell, when they wished to sell, but only to Englishmen, or to the English government, and so forth, the British government, I should say, and likewise for the French and the Spanish and so on. That's the great right. But Indians are not sovereign, and indeed, I'm sure of this. One of the few things I'm sure of, the text of the Constitution does not have the word sovereignty in it. Correct me, please.
It doesn't have the word sovereignty in it. I wasn't going to challenge that. I think it would be useful for us to understand what we all mean, maybe, and particularly what you mean, though, by sovereignty. I have the feeling that you are including in this word some ideas that I don't include in it necessarily. It sounds like it's an absolute term. In other words, that it means a certain, only one kind of political power, or one scope of political power, and that is of a foreign nation, essentially. I mean, this kind of sovereignty that France and Russia and the United States and so forth exercise.
I'll say what I mean. This won't do if one were dealing with international law, because it's too crude. But what I mean by it is this. Humanly speaking, okay, I'm leaving God out of this, okay, for the moment.
Good.
Okay. Humanly speaking, who has the last word?
Right. Well, that takes me to my point regarding the Constitution and sovereignty. And there's nothing in it specifically, but I think there are some hints. The fact the United States controls, regulates commerce with foreign nations among the Indian tribes and with the states.
No, among the several states and
with
the Indian tribes.
Sorry, but with the foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes, says to me, implies to me, some kind of political relationship between the United States as a government and these various other entities as governments or political units of some kind. I think the argument is certainly there that there is an implicit political relationship that is embodied in the Commerce Clause and in those very prepositional phrases, and I think that has to. I think that there is something in the Constitution that addresses the question of sovereignty. Now, to say that a community is a domestic dependent nation, I think I agree with you. It says all those things. It says it is within the boundaries of the United States. Not because they want to be within the boundaries of the United States, but because, in fact, the United States is able by military force, essentially, to maintain its boundaries.
Oh, let's face it, the United States came to the Indians. The Indians
sure,
didn't come
right,
to the United
right,
States.
Right, right. And dependent in ways that I think we can talk about political dependency. We can also talk about social dependency. But the point is that they are also, legally at least, in the doctrine, nations. which again has a political content, and I don't think we have to talk in terms of sovereignty being an absolute sovereignty, that is a matter of complete independence in order for it to have some content and validity.
Now, what's the language of the Commerce Clause? To regulate commerce with foreign nations among the several states and
with the Indian tribes.
With the Indian tribes. Okay.
Okay. So, I mean, there's a tendency, and we found this in the other earlier meetings, to talk about sovereignty in sort of absolute terms, you know, as though we were talking about Libya when we were talking about native sovereignty. And I question that characterization of sovereignty as being an absolute term. It is a buzzword, unfortunately, and it sends off bells in people's heads that makes it very difficult to think about it, I think. But maybe self-rule or something like that would be
more neutral. Then we're dealing with something else, because I didn't say where I thought sovereignty resided under the Constitution of the United States. And maybe you don't want to know what I think about it anyway, because whether I think it in one place or another won't either make it so or not make it so. But I agree with you, Mr. Case, that people mean a lot of different things by the same words, and to the extent that they're used, people may not realize that they're dealing with clipped coinage here, and think that they're passing out good money. I'm reluctant to get into to add to the legalistic glossing of legal texts, of which we've had so much. The Commerce Clause is not the only place where Indians are mentioned in the Constitution. Indians not taxed, I recall, some such phrase. And of course, the Commerce Clause speaks first and foremost of commerce. It says commerce. The political relations among the several states are dealt with in other places in the Constitution. Colorado and New Mexico can't make a little deal for themselves, enlarging the one, diminishing the other, splitting off, taking care of the Colorado River by themselves because it suits them, without Congress having some say-so about this. So political relations are dealt with in other places as far as the states are concerned. And if one assumes great attention and care devoted to the language of the Constitution by those who wrote it or who gave it its final style and form, then maybe there would be some reason to wonder whether the Commerce Clause simply is dealing with political entities in their political relations. I don't want to get into that. I can't say. I don't know that I can even make a persuasive case one way or the other about that, so I wouldn't pretend. But there is this thing about sovereignty in the Constitution. We have to remind ourselves that there's a long history among the whites about where that sovereignty is located. It was a history that ended up with many more corpses than all the Indian wars rolled up in one. One day of that war from 1861 to 65 produced more corpses than all the wars between the whites and the reds. South Carolina was not a sovereign state. And even though you might go down south and hear people talk about the sovereign state of X and the sovereign state of Y, tain't so. On the other hand, it's not clear under the Constitution, or at least it's not clear to me, that the federal government is given a blank check to do anything it bloody well pleases. It's a constitution of limited powers. And what isn't granted is allegedly reserved to the states or to the people, according to Amendment 10. And according to the preamble, it says, we the people. They seem to be the ones who are giving and taking, sharing and redistributing. So maybe they're the sovereign. It's arguable. I really don't want to dwell on this because I don't think, I mean, aside from serving as some kind of caution against using words that have enormous freight, immense consequences, and that are more likely to be misunderstood than understood, more likely to raise people's hackles than to give them the confidence that this is a line of inquiry that one might go into without leading to terrible results. Beyond warning against that, I don't want to really dwell on sovereignty unless, but of course, I'm not forbidding anyone else from dwelling on it.
Could I just make one point?
Please.
Could you use the mic?
Just one point. In raising the issue of sovereignty originally, you referred to the British tradition of treating with the Indian people. Certainly, the most informed discussion of British practice in the 18th and 19th century was that written by Duncan Campbell Scott in 1914, just as he took over the Deputy Superintendency of Indian Affairs in Canada. And he specifically described the British practice of treating with Indians as treating as with a sovereign power. So whatever the case in the clauses in the Constitution, it was Scott's view, quite specifically, that the British tradition was to acknowledge the sovereignty of the Indian tribes.
Okay. Good. But when the negotiators at the Treaty of Paris of 1781, and this, of course, was before the treaty was signed, worked over the problem of settling what we call the Revolutionary War. There was no place in there for the Indians. The Indians were, so to speak, forgotten by their allies, the other high contracting powers, a cause of considerable embitterment to those Indians in the East who had not only depended on the British, but fought for them.
Well, that can be looked on as a sin of omission on the part of the European powers. It doesn't necessarily mean that there was no sovereignty residing in those Indian tribes. What I'm saying is that it certainly was the view of one of the most experienced inheritors of a British tradition, Duncan Campbell Scott, who was superintendent for 20 years from 1913 to 1932, that the British tradition involved an acknowledgement of the sovereignty of the Indian tribes.
So that when Sir William Johnson negotiated with various tribes of the Iroquois Confederacy and so on, he was dealing with...
Scott's comment comes right immediately following a discussion of Johnson. Yes.
Okay, fine. All that may be so, and of course it wouldn't be the only aspect of British policy that was overturned by the American revolutionaries.
No, though the language of the amendment to the Indian Appropriations Act in 1871 seems to refer, if only obliquely, to that tradition.
Yeah, well, that may very well be. And there's the contemporary understanding and practice having to do with the ratification of treaties that the Senate gave in 1790. One of the things, and I speak of as someone at the margins of this thing, I said at the beginning, I am not a lawyer and I'm not an Indian expert. One of the things that struck me is how difficult this record, insofar as I'm familiar with it, how difficult it is to extract from this record anything that is more than a probable case. It's a rare day that you get a probable case. I don't believe that there's a demonstration in the lot, one way or the other. You have more or less probable cases. Well, let me continue, if I may, because I'd be happy to leave sovereignty, because I think it's a cul-de-sac, and ask the question, if not sovereignty, then what? Is one simply reduced to the general proposition that might makes right? I would argue that the American language is the language of rights, and that's language that's been used here by all kinds of people. But except for one mention by Mr. Coulter at the end of his remarks this morning, I haven't heard anyone speak of the grounds of those rights. What do they rest on? People have talked about group rights. There's been talk about the ideology of non-Indians, of non-native peoples. But, and of the Protestant ethic, and so on. Those are not, I believe, the grounds on which American rights are founded. The rights that the Americans thought they relied on, that they relied on in declaring independence, that they relied on in establishing the Constitution, were rights that they believed, quaintly enough, to rest on nature, whatever they meant by nature. Again, I have to emphasize that the basis of American rights was not what Las Casas or a Jesuit theologian had to say about it. They thought that there were laws of nature and of nature's God, and that the rights that they enjoyed and that were indispensable for their life were grounded on those natural rights. The thing that creates special difficulty, and especially in things having to do with ANSCA and so on, is that those rights were understood by the framers of the Constitution, by the founders of the American government, and by their predecessors among the Anglo-Americans, to be rights inhering in individuals. They did not speak of group rights, though those individuals might be grouped in any number of ways. The rights that Baptists enjoyed or sought to enjoy in Virginia under an Episcopalian established church were rights that they sought for themselves as individuals, though they acted collectively. It was the right of a man to worship God his way and without supporting a church that he neither adhered to nor maybe even respected. Was the right to enjoy his property, to take that deer which he hunted down and eat it, and not to have hunted it and have it taken away from him. It was a right to enjoy his liberty. So we're talking about rights of person, we're talking about rights of property, we're talking about rights of conscience that were held to be inalienable. You couldn't give it away, and it couldn't be taken from you. those were rights that, it was said, inhered in us as individuals. Now, the Indian claims, or more generally, the native people's claims, as far as I understand them from what I've read and what I've heard here, are presented as emphatically a claim of group rights. And indeed, if I haven't mistaken what has been said and how it's been said, that claim is even from time to time disdainful of individual rights, regarding them as somehow subversive of group rights or of the enjoyment of group rights. I'm in no position, I have no authority, I have no right to advise you about how you ought to take care of your business. Maybe 3/4 of the problems that Native peoples have had is that they've had all these other people telling them how to take care of their own business. I only make this little comment. I find it strange, and in some peculiar way self-defeating, that Native peoples should eschew, should reject, give the back of the hand to that very special protection that American law affords to protect individuals in the things that come closest to them. That protection can be rejected as culture-bound, as left-handed brain, or anything you want. But the fundamental fact, it seems to me, is that you are living under the Constitution of the United States, that you go to a white man's court and white man's law, and that the protection that you seek can only be had that way. Of course one will get supportive resolutions from the United Nations. Who has any problems in the UN condemning the violations of human rights of another country? It's fair game. Composed only of the holy and the pure when dealing with all places outside their boundaries. But there's no way in which those resolutions or even, quote, laws, if they were passed, could be enforceable in an American court. There's no political way in which that's going to come about. It's analogous to the kind of restraint that Chief Justice Marshall exercised in dealing with what was a very shady, problematic would be a kind and gentle word to use, history of white claims over Indians. He said, and I think this hasn't been mentioned in the various discussions of Johnson or of the other Indian cases, it wasn't for a court constituted under the sovereign to question the acts of that sovereign. Political questions, the political questions doctrine, is an act of self-preservation on the part of a judiciary. Those 5, 7, 9, whatever the composition of the Supreme Court was at the time, those men are not going to get off the bench, run down to Georgia and grab someone by the scruff of his neck and throw him off. They depend on the only power to enforce the law that there is, which is under the executive as authorized by the legislature. If one wants to make points that we are sinners and that we've dealt wrongly and that one wants that one ought to express contrition for misgivings, compassion for the weak and the vulnerable, and so on, that's okay. But you can't end it with a thus saith, it is so ordered, the way a court ends its decisions. Even the very limited order that the court handed down in Cherokee didn't travel out of Washington. Everybody knows the well-known statement of Jackson. John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it. Apocryphal, but do you know what? True. He doesn't have to have said it. Not everything that's a matter of historical record is ipso facto false. It's truer than, I mean, it's as true if we had a piece of paper in which he said, today I said to someone X. That's the fact. That doesn't mean one has to agree with it. That doesn't mean that one has to simply reconcile oneself to it. But it's a fact that you have to take into your own accounting of what to do and how to do it. I'll just close with a remark about Alaska, in which I'm almost an expert, having been here getting close to 48 hours. There might be something possible in Alaska that certainly wasn't possible in New York State, not very possible in Georgia, and maybe not really possible anywhere else in the lower 48 states. First of all, you're talking about an immense amount of land, which in some sense you have. I don't know if you can establish enclaves unto yourselves, or whether those kids who have cassette recorders would want to live there. But it's a large enough body of land to make possible some kind of accommodation, some kind of creative accommodation among your own desires, your own conflicting desires, to satisfy your pride in what your parents were, your hopes for what your children might be, and still have some kind of protection that you can seek only in one place. From that government that is committed, however imperfectly, to the protection of individual rights. I think that takes imagination. And it's an imagination that's going to have to come not from lawyers, the lawyers might be called in at a late stage, but from your own understanding of how you want to live and what you want to be. I think that's about what I have to say.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Lerner. I said that you were a professor of philosophy. I think I'm right in saying that you are a professor of political philosophy at the University of Chicago.
No, I haven't reached that that status. I teach social sciences.
I see. Well,
okay.
That's still a marvelous thing to be doing. Could I, as chairman, perhaps raise the first question, working kind of backwards through your remarks? And you, coming from a small country next door, that is Canada, where we watch in wonder and fascination what goes on in the United States, and have learned to live with the hyperbole with which Americans usually describe themselves and their institutions, you used a phrase that. That we're used to hearing from spokesmen for America. You said that the Bill of Rights constitutes that very special protection that American law affords. It seems to me that the provisions in the Bill of Rights were derived from Anglo-Saxon law and having those same measures have been incorporated for decades in Canadian law, through the legal force of what we call the common law. They haven't been codified in a constitution. That was, in fact, done in 1982. And Canada wrote a new constitution, and we did something that I'm sure alarms political scientists. We took the guarantees in the Bill of Rights, which were enacted in the heyday of ideas of individual liberty in the 18th century, and they are all in the Constitution and entrenched in what we call a Charter of Rights. But in addition, in Canada, and I'm just raising this because you might want to consider whether this may or may not be a departure from and a departure of significance, and perhaps one to be deplored, but nevertheless a departure from the political thinking that inspired and still inspires the U.S. Constitution. But in addition to the protection afforded those individual rights, and it is that very special protection that American law affords and which many other countries have afforded their people, but in addition, in our Constitution, we provided that the English-speaking minority in the province of Quebec should, it has always had a certain right under our Constitution since 1867 to denominational schools and to public funds that go to French-speaking people for denominational schools. It's a group right that goes back to 1867, if we're going to use that expression, group rights. It went to Catholics in 1867. In 1982, the burden of French-carrying, French-Canadian culture had shifted, or at least the principal focus of it was language. And so there are minority language education rights for English-speaking Canadians in Quebec, and minority language education rights for French-speaking people in all the other provinces where they are a minority. And those reflect, in a way, the rights for Protestants and Catholics that were written into the Constitution back in 1867. They are now for English and French-speaking persons. We also provided that there is a provision that says the rights of the Aboriginal peoples of Canada, Indians, Inuit, and Métis, are hereby recognized and affirmed. I think that's the expression. And then there is a provision that defines the Aboriginal peoples of Canada as the Indians, the Inuit, and the Métis. And
define their rights?
No. I was coming to that. That's a subject that will not be exhausted for some considerable time. But there is also a provision in the Constitution that says at regular intervals the Prime Minister of Canada and the premiers of the provinces, equivalent to the governors of the states, but they are much more powerful figures because under the parliamentary system they an agreement by a premier representing his province to amend the Constitution is tantamount to the legislature agreeing, so that the meetings of first ministers, of the prime minister and the premiers, may actually reach accord on amendments to the Constitution. But there is a provision that says at regular intervals the first ministers, the prime minister and the premiers, must meet with the representatives of the Aboriginal people to work out some kind of definition of these rights. And the first of these meetings was held last year. The second is being held this week in Canada and is being televised to the whole country from gavel to gavel, or whatever the expression is. There is also a provision that may offend some political philosophers, but it's an interesting provision that says that Canada's nothing in the Constitution is to deny Canada's multicultural heritage. Now, that's more a symbolic provision than anything else, although one never knows what in decades to come its impact might be.
Is that the language? Nothing is to deny?
The multicultural heritage. No, it's not a reference to language, but to the multitude of peoples who have immigrated to Canada in recent years, and where the it is an attempt to affirm their right to continue to pursue their own cultural traditions to the extent that is appropriate, and I use that word appropriate as a neutral word. There's another provision that, while we're on the subject, that may be of interest to you, and that is a provision that says that
excuse me, because this is all new to me. The language says that that multicultural heritage is not to be denied to the extent that it is appropriate.
No, I'm sorry, I'm not reflecting the language accurately, and I'm trying to think of the specific words, but it is a symbolic affirmation of Canada's multicultural heritage. It is actually in, it isn't a preamble. It might have, the preamble contains references to God and so on, but this provision is included there, and it is designed to affirm the right to pursue a distinctive cultural identity for those who are not English or French, who are regarded as the founding peoples, and are not Aboriginal peoples, who are otherwise identified in the Constitution. So, I'm not trying to make this into a long lecture, but I've always been fascinated by the direction that we took in our working out new constitutional arrangements in 1982, and we had the advantage of such, it may be thought to be, and he has resigned now, so we can say that we had the advantage of a prime minister who is regarded as a political philosopher. I'm not saying whether he's a good one or a bad one, but he came to office with that reputation, having written extensively on all of these questions. Well, anyway, that's a footnote to that, and you might now or later wish to comment on it, and whether or not this is the wave of the future or a kind of aberration that all others should be warned against. But please go ahead, sir.
As I said, much of that was new to me. I had heard that you had made given a new and higher status to whatever had served as a Bill of Rights before. Of course, you know, the people who made the Constitution of the United States didn't think it needed a Bill of Rights. They thought it was itself a Bill of Rights. There was a concession to anti-federalist opinion. But, I don't know whether that's a model for other peoples. I suppose by the principles of the Declaration, there's a right of people to institute governments as shall seem fit to them, as best to secure their liberties, and maybe that makes sense.
Nature's God offered a new revelation that was not available to the founding fathers.
Let me assure you that prophecy has departed from Israel, and I have no private pipeline to the divine will or intention. I see no more than anyone else, and probably a good deal less. It would be gratuitous in the extreme for the Constitution of the United States, given its presupposition that what is not granted is reserved to the people or the states, for it to say that we're not going to come down heavily upon, or that we're going to be especially solicitous of the multicultural heritage of the people. America was a much more diverse population, I suspect, in 1787 than the Canadians were, in terms of points of national origin and so on, if we're talking about the European settlers. The whole business of group rights raises the question, and maybe you and Canada will ultimately have to face it, or maybe not even very far down the pike. What's a group? Which groups? Who's the authentic spokesman for this group? It makes the question, who's the authentic spokesman for the Menominee, look like small potatoes. That's very troublesome. And of course, the notion that you're affirming rights that aren't specified, you know, leads to the question, what does it mean? How do those rights differ from the rights enjoyed by other Canadians, and so on? Hard to know. The Supreme Court, at least under the Constitution, hasn't had difficulties saying all sorts of things can't be done, even though they might be claimed to be rights. I mean, for example, the right to practice polygamy has been held to be out of the question. I don't know. I mean, the court then thought it was grossly immoral, though one might say one of the most moral men who ever lived was himself a polygamist, Abraham. Okay, you know, I mean, it's not obvious that it's, but they had their reasons and they did it. The business with group rights really raises a hornet's nest here, and their definition, their enforcement vis-a-vis other group rights. What, for example, are the group rights of blacks in the city of Chicago as distinguished from Hispanic-speaking people in the city of Chicago, okay? As distinguished from Poles. I mean, you have infinite fragmentation possible there, especially if those rights are seen in practice to press against one another. I hear that this morning on the radio and talking about some moose reserve out here and the rights of those who want to watch moose, the rights of those who want to fish around where the moose are, those who just want to leave the moose alone. Okay, I mean, how can one constitutionally embody all these things? This is the stuff of political legislation, negotiation, dealing. Yeah, that dirty stuff, dealing. I don't know how they can be secured in any meaningful way. If you're talking about individuals, you've got something there. Though even there, as I suggested, it isn't without its problems.
Could I just, before
But that's not to say what the Canadians ought to do for themselves.
Yeah. There's one other feature of this that, your institutions were in many ways derived from British institutions,
right.
And I think the Founding Fathers were quite prepared to admit that.
They took pride in it.
Yes, and our institutions in Canada are largely shaped by the British tradition and to some extent by the French tradition. But those are both, at least they were at the relevant times, homogeneous states with essentially populations of one race speaking one language. In fact, one had an established religion, and the others, France, its religion wasn't established, but it just about everybody it was Catholic. Then here we are on a new continent, and we try to transplant these institutions, and there are indigenous people here with their own institutions. Canada may belatedly have tried to address that. In its that condition, in its Constitution of 1982, what Professor Johnson and Mr. Jim and Tim Coulter and David Case have been talking about this morning is the way in which American law tried to come to grips with this state of affairs and not in a way that's altogether satisfactory to all concerned. One other thing I might just, and I mention this for the benefit of everybody else at the table and in case they decide to comment on it later in the week. In Canada, an all-party committee of the Canadian Parliament, we have three national parties, and a committee representing all parties handed in a report to Parliament last year called the Penner Report, in which they urged that, and this had the unanimous agreement of representatives of all parties, it isn't the formal policy of any party, and certainly not of the government, but Ted Chamberlain may take the matter farther than I've been able to, because there may have been recent developments I'm unaware of, but in it, it was urged that we recognize in Canada that the Indian governments are a third order of government, federal government, provincial governments, Indian governments, which may or may not be implemented by the government, but it is an interesting culmination to the flow of events over a little more than a decade, it will be interesting to see where it leads. Yes, Ralph Johnson.
Well, I might add one supplement or footnote or disagreement, I'm not quite sure what it is. The United States Constitution does not explicitly identify Indians, except so far as I know in the two instances that you mentioned, but it's also true that the Constitution essentially left Indians out of the equation. This has been demonstrated by the fact, for example, that Indian governments are not constrained by the Bill of Rights of the Constitution of the United States. They are now, since 1968, constrained by the Indian Civil Rights Act. But before that time, and even now, if a tribal government or a tribal court takes some action that